Welcome to another episode of Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. And this week, I am flying solo again, but it's all good because I got air in my lungs, there's hope in the air, and I am joined by Chris, the Godfather, Lumser. I hope I said that last name right. We're doing a crossover this week with the Long Coat Mafia podcast. What's going on, Chris?
Oh, not much. Willing to say you're the first person to get my last name right on the first try.
Yes! Which is normally because, like, I have a history, and one of my co-hosts, Sean, can attest to this, is that I have the hardest problem saying people's names. So that makes me, like, you just made my day.
Well, like I said, not many people, I've heard such botched jobs, it's disgusting. And even when I try to explain it, somewhat simply, but people still don't get it. But still.
Well, sweet. All right, man. So you are from a show called the Long Coat Mafia podcast, and you guys are like episodes leaps and bounds ahead of us. This is episode 41 for us. So how long have you been doing Long Coat Mafia podcast? Before you tell me that, tell me a little bit about yourself, man.
What do you want to know? Because that question is very vague. I don't mean that in a bad way. Basically, I'm a West Virginia resident. I am a big nerd in a lot of ways, geek and nerd. I've been doing. I tend to learn a lot from my friends. I have a lot of friends who are musicians who do work with film and all that. So I tend to pick up what they know. And when I go into discussion with other people, they don't really get that I know all this. And sometimes it's like, how do you know this? It's that I've learned from friends. And to me, that's fascinating. But if you don't want to go a little bit personal, I'm going to be 42 this year. So in essence, that's a geek number to a lot of people with the Hitchhiker's Guide. So I'm going to be celebrating that some way, somehow. But I usually tell people when it comes to my cred, I got more than most and less than some. And right now I'm being envious of Chris Hardwick because he's been posting up his animation cell collection, and it's far better than mine. So
what gives you something to strive for? I mean,
yeah, the only downside is he's got money, I don't.
That's true. That's definitely something, I guess, being in the podcast game we all relate to, independent realm. So tell us a little bit about the Long Coat Mafia podcast. What kind of what do you guys cover? How did you guys get started? All that other good stuff.
The Long Coat Mafia is pretty much I derived the name, even though a lot of people might think it has that negative stigmata to it, because they hear long coats and mafia, they think about the whole Columbine thing. It's completely different because I'm coming from a geek aspect of it all, meaning that when you look at a lot of great films and great things that geek culture has provided, a lot of the best villains, a lot of the best heroes all have that long coat, whether it be a duster or a lab coat, so forth and so on. That's where that aspect comes from. And when you see a lot of the old-time gangster movies, mafia is not only the mob, but it also means kind of like a family aspect. So I want to try to bring the geek aspect of family into what we do. And so it's the whole aspect is that we are a geek podcast, and we try to do a lot of geek topics, geek interviews with a lot of things that most people don't understand or know about, meaning that if we recently, both you and I were at the Winter Poppin' Comic Wonderland this past December, I got a chance to interview two great voice actors that were there, and which was good to bring to my listeners because they might watch things like Pokemon or Naruto or stuff like that, but they don't know what goes behind that aspect. So I'm able to interview them with that aspect of bringing that geek culture and news from that show, but let them know what goes on to be a voice actor, a musician, and so forth and so on. So it's a little bit, it's something for the non-geek and for the geek as well. And we also try to do a little bit of social commentary because a lot of things that happen in the geek culture, outside the geek culture, do affect what's inside the geek culture.
That's kind of a little bit like what we do is, you know, bringing the whole like suicide prevention element into the geek culture, because like we had talked about at the convention, there are so many people, whether you call it cosplayers or, you know, you call it just people that come and enjoy and have been, you know, lifelong fans, or maybe they're just starting to get into it. There's a lot of people in this comic culture that have really struggled with suicide, or they've struggled with depression, or they know someone that has, and it's a reason, like, they do this kind of culture to, in essence, escape where they are. I don't know how to exactly say it, but, like, where they are kind of hounded by these demons, almost, so to say. And so, because that's such a big statement to make. So what kind of social issues do you guys really address on your podcast, and how often is it a normal thing for you guys?
Right now we've done, as far as I can remember, at least two major episodes that were kind of designated as social commentary. This past November, a good friend of mine became my co-host for the day. We did an election special, kind of going on both sides of the issue, and to really try to strive our listeners to go out and vote, if not for whoever the presidential candidate was or of their choosing, but at least vote for the more local aspects of their community. Like here in West Virginia, we had two bills on the ballot. One was for what was called the Sunday brunch bill, which allowed local restaurants and mom and pop restaurants to serve alcohol before noon on Sundays, if they were legally able to serve alcohol during their normal business hours. And the other one was a Sunday hunting bill, allow hunters to hunt on their own property on Sundays. So stuff like that we want to get out to have the people vote. The other one that we did was earlier that year, and it was in essence about basic feminism, what it kind of means to us, and we opened it up to anyone who was designated a diehard feminist, and I don't mean that in a negative connotation in any way, to come on and challenge what we said on the show, and how some of the negative aspects of feminism can affect the geek culture, meaning, as you probably know, there are a lot of geeks out there that have anxiety issues and social issues, and which some of the uber diehard feminists have that negative aspect of, even if you approach a woman, you're doing something wrong to them. And it was my point that I was trying to bring out, that saying that to someone who has anxiety issues, you're doing more harm than good. You should be promoting that there should be more, less friction between the two genders than, you know, how dare you talk to me because you are a man, or because... It to me, that was my passion. I wanted to get out, and my co-host Big Candy was trying to, you know, keep me centered before I go out on a complete tangent. That's why I surround myself with some great co-hosts to keep me from going on that distant tangent.
Are you an Arrow fan at all?
A what?
An Arrow fan.
You mean the show? Yeah.
Or
as I like to call it sometimes, Smallville Light.
It's a little darker than Smallville.
I don't mean a lighter comedic show. I mean in reference to how they treat done things, in reference to the drama and everything else. It's, for me, it's, as a fan, a casual DC fan, it's a very lighter show. I'm less aggravated from when I was watching Smallville.
Oh, okay. Well, like, the only reason, the only tangents that I ever get on when it comes to stuff like just in the geek culture is I hate how they consistently keep bringing back Malcolm Merlyn and the Harrison Wells characters. So, like, my people just, like, they're like, it's okay. They got a plan. I'm like, they need to go with, like, they were great in their prime, and then they just kind of just kept coming back and back and back, but.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and it's like, oh, man, geez, really? You really had to go there? It's like I'm talking at my TV like I would normally talk to a B-movie. It's like I'm sitting there yelling at my screen, like, why did you really have to do that again? Oh, it's an evil twin this week. Oh, dear God, why? My co-host, Big Candy, was around when Smallville was still on the air, and he didn't watch it, but he loved hearing me do the weekly commentary, and he was like, that's why, you know, we got to, initially, when we first did podcasting, he's like, we got to sit down and record this. That was about 10 years ago. And now, the revamp, which is the Long Coat Mafia, is me in control of everything right now. I hate to go back on a previous topic, but this is also to answer your question about the show. I got started back again because I needed something to do. I needed a way to be more creative and be more vocal. And when me and my buddy got back together to reignite our friendship, because he recently got married, had a kid, and so forth and so on, and we got to, again, it was just one of those things that our conversation was like, oh, dear God, we got to start recording this. And he said, well, if you're able to get a mic and everything together, let's start up the podcast again. I said, all right, I get to choose the name. I get to choose, you know, how it's run. And he said, okay, if you get it started, I'll be there. And then he also gave me the statements like, ah, you're not going to do this. And all of a sudden, a month and a half later, I have a mic, I have my laptop, I have all the software ready to go. And he was like, I don't believe you actually did this. Well, you put the challenge out there, and I'm ready to do this. And he said, I said, there's one other stipulation other than me being in control is that I'm going to bring in a female co-host, and that's Zombie Bunny, who's a cosplayer, and she's a great co-host. She has to be back on the show. She has some work scheduling issues. It's kind of tough for her to get on the show because of she doesn't have a ride to get to the show a lot of times, so it's kind of trying to figure out everybody's schedule, and which I'm sure you know is kind of a hard thing to do when it comes to scheduling recording dates for a podcast.
Yeah, that's been one of the toughest things that when we first started, like, we never really had like a designated day where we would sit down. It was always like we waited till the Friday before we would do everything, and we would book that. We'd already have the guests booked, and we'd be like, all right, well, I'm juggling this schedule, my schedule, my co-host schedule, and then we added a third co-host, and it was like trying to like juggle all these things together. And then probably when we kind of went through a soft reboot, started doing the suicide prevention, we started kind of getting a little bit more organized. So now all the notes are done Mondays, all the recordings are done Wednesdays, all of the editing's done on Thursdays, and all of the episodes go live Fridays. So, I mean, for, like, outside of, like, special episodes, normal episodes for us go up every Friday, but it has been rough, and now that we're on a network, we have a commitment to them, so we can't juggle around multiple people's schedules. It's like, essentially the show has to go on with or without them, unfortunately. And I love them to death that they have still been patient with me to kind of go and do my thing, and this baby that we started together, that they're so supportive of it, and they come on when they can. But it's hard when you have a co-host who has two jobs, split custody, and then you have another one who is trying to have a thriving music career and is working works nights. It makes it kind of difficult, but we're in the process of like getting schedules done and everything. So
yeah, my co-host Big Candy just had his an issue with him in regards to his working status. I'm not going to go into it here. That's between him and his employer. But a lot of his schedule just opened up, or will open up in regards over the next month or so. So what will probably be happening is that I might have a little bit more host-based episodes, because he said all I have to do is drop my son off at daycare if need be, and while my wife works, and therefore, if you want to record, just let me know. And I said the same things, like, well, if you want to record, and if you're able to drop your son off at daycare for a few hours, just let me know, and I'll see what I can get together and what I could schedule. So, which is kind of a good thing, and it's just a matter of getting Zombie Bunny back into the studio and get her laughing again, so, which will hopefully be nice. Our studio door is always open to her to have the come in and schedule an episode and so forth and so on. So,
all right, man. Well, we're talking about teamwork here, and we're talking about friends and co-hosts. So this just kind of makes me want to jump into our first story and our first universe. And we are starting with all Marvel stories this week. So this is an interesting one, and I want to start off by saying that this is simply a rumor. But let's rewind the clocks a little bit back. A picture surfaced on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, featuring Hugh Jackman, Ryan Reynolds, and Pierce Brosnan. Now, the former two, and Jackman and Reynolds, are most famously currently known for being Wolverine and Deadpool in Fox's X-Men universe, which led many to believe that Brosnan would be playing Cable in the upcoming sequel to the Merc with a Mouth. Now, apparently, reports are backing up fan theories. But again, this is just simply a rumor, so we're going to kind of talk about whether or not you think Brosnan would fit the role of Cable for this Ryan Reynolds come sequel.
Personally, I don't see it. You know, I'm not knocking Pierce Brosnan as an actor. He's done a lot of decent acting roles with a 007, but personally, I've seen a lot of other actors that visually come a little bit more closer to the appearance of Cable. But to kind of flip that opinion a little bit, how many times have we said, as fans, at least with the DC universe, that actor is not going to be a decent XYZ character, and turns out they're perfect for that part. We've definitely seen it with Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. There were a lot of fans saying that, he wouldn't be a perfect Wolverine, and it turns out he's done a bang-up job over the past, 17 years. It hasn't been that long. Wow. So, personally, I don't see it. I'm willing to see footage, or at least wait for the trailer to come out with his scenes in it. Maybe some of the set leaks, if there are any, of how they're going to have his character if he does come out to be Cable.
I don't know. It's been a long time since you've kind of seen him in anything really that's been big budget like this. Obviously, a lot of people know him as 007, James Bond. He was, GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, Die Another Day. Did he have a fourth one?
I don't know. I want to say yes, but I'm not sure.
Regardless, so you have three or four like big blockbuster in an iconic role. He crushed it as Bond, but I feel like ever since then I haven't really seen him in much, so I can't really judge by the whole like acting thing. I've seen him in like a couple like smaller budget movies, but I mean, obviously Deadpool is not going to be a $150 million made movie. They're sticking with the smaller screen, the smaller role, so I don't know, like visually I feel like like you had said, like there's other actors visually that would be more appealing. I think he's not really, and I could be totally wrong. Like, I just after seeing Don't Breathe, I feel like the blind guy from Don't Breathe, whose name has escaped me at the moment, would be.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, he just, for like such a guy his age, he was jacked in that movie, and like just kind of seeing that he was already kind of like had like the eye, like I could just see that whole like eyepiece that Cable has, and I'm not really like that. Like, he's just more built, but I think as far as acting ability to go, I don't know. I've never seen Brosnan in any kind of comedic role other than The Simpsons, so I don't really know if he could pull off kind of the comedy aspects that Deadpool would bring up, or you know how the chemistry would be between Reynolds and Brosnan too. I think is going to be a big thing that's going to either make or break that movie. Oh, it's Stephen Lang. That's the guy's name. Yeah. So I don't know, but then again, I don't know if I could ever see Lang and Reynolds kind of have chemistry too. So I feel like Ryan Reynolds set the bar so high with the first one that to kind of get another guy in there, it'll be interesting to see like who can really kind of have chemistry with him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you were right. Pierce Brosnan did do 4 Bond films. He did, let's see. He did GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, Die Another Day, and The World Is Not Enough. I think the closest thing he's come to a comedic role was Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, yeah, he was in Mrs. Doubtfire. I forgot.
So, but I think in that he played more of a straight man. But what can you play against the great comedian, God rest his soul, Robin Williams? So, and it's nothing against Pierce Brosnan, but the actor that you did bring up that was in,
Don't Breathe.
Yeah, Avatar. He has that, that build for it. He seems a little, he's built for it a little bit. He's got the visual image to it, but height-wise, I think his name, I want to say his name is, oh, it's Kevin Nash. Former wrestler Kevin Nash would be my second choice, because he's got more height and he's got more shoulder width, if you could understand that. Meaning he's more of a, I know, I hear the keyboard, you're looking it up. He, just a little bit, he,
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I don't think he has enough acting chops to do it, but he has the visual thing that a lot of fans might say, oh yeah, that's almost a perfect fit. He's got the height, he's got the physique for it, while the other actor has more of the facial characteristics for it. So, we'll see.
Well, it looks like here too, it looks like he has a little bit more of the comedic roles. Like, I'm looking at his filmography right now. He's got Grandma's Boy, who is obviously the wrestling with, you know, TNT and WCW. What else has he got here? Punisher, John Wick, Magic Mike, Longest Yard. So he definitely has more of that comedic chops to him. But I don't know. I feel like you said, like, there's just so many people that initially when they were announced for, like, comic book movies, you just hear them and you're just like, I can't see it. Then you see the movie and you're like, for what they were going for, like, this was perfect. Like, I thought Jesse Eisenberg in BVS was perfect. Despite what so many people, you know, had problems with that movie, I thought that when they unraveled this character in the Ultimate Edition, he played it so geniusly. And so many people had their doubts about Ben Affleck as Batman, and he crushed it. Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman killed it in BVS. And, like, that's just, I know that that's all DC, but, you know, that's just kind of where I'm going. And I think Mark Ruffalo was another thing that I didn't really see as the Hulk. And then he did the Avengers, and he did a great job. And he he's the best Hulk that we've had to date. So I think it'll be interesting if they get Brosnan to play it, because I would like to see him in something. He's a talented dude. He just hasn't done anything in a while.
According to his IMDb, he's done quite a bit over the past few years. But it's just that a lot of what he's...
nothing that really stands out. Yeah.
Right, and it's mostly like the Hallmark Channel drama stuff, which he's more known for is that other than the Bond films, 007 films, he hasn't really done any action movies. It's more the smaller person A has interest in person B, and that's it. So if it was me casting the film, I'd go with someone like Kevin Nash, who has a lot of acting cred in action movies and might hold up with a little bit of the comedic timing that Ryan Reynolds will pull for Deadpool. But again, that's not up to me or a lot of the fans as much as we would like it. It's up to the casting director. So,
I think that it's what it's really going to depend on, what's really going to hinder on, again, is the chemistry between the two. And he's due for a comeback, so bring him on. Like, give us Cable. Like, just make the announcement. Like, let's just have this already.
About the only thing I have concerns with the sequel for Deadpool is how many people would actually know, other than the fandom of Deadpool and Marvel, would know who Cable is. So you would have to... there's that little bit of element that there's going to be a screw-up somewhere in it. But who knows?
They've taken their time with it. And it seems like every other than Apocalypse, it seems like every movie they've done since Days of Future Past has been well orchestrated, well thought out, and so. But we'll see. I mean, we'll have to wait for an announcement. But moving on to the next story, it seems like Marvel just keeps them coming with this casting news. The difference between our first story and this story is that this one's confirmed, it's legit, press release, all of it. We already know that Marvel inked a deal with Hulu for a Runaways TV show, and now we know who will be playing them, and a whole bunch of names that I'm going to screw up right now. So if any of these people seem to be listening, by whatever chance, I'm sorry. So Renzi Felice will be playing Alex Wilder. He is of Teen Wolf fame. Lyrica O'Kanna from The Affair will be playing Nico Minoru. Virginia Gardner from Goat will be playing Caroline Dean. Ariella Bear from New Girl will be playing Gert Yorks. Greg Sulkin from Faking It will be playing Chase Stein. And Allegora Acosta will be playing from 100 Things to Do Before High School will be playing Molly Henderson. So I know next to nothing about these actors. I don't know anything about the property of Runaways. I initially threw this story in there for our listeners. So do you know anything about the Runaways?
Rented Lips. From what I remember of the comic book run, this was when it first came out, what these, I don't want to say kids, what these kids were sons and daughters of either heroes or villains, and they stumbled, like most mutants do, stumbled into their powers as teens, and they didn't want to be like their parents, so in essence they ran away, and hijinks ensue. A lot of your listeners might be saying that I'm oversimplifying it, but basically that's it. That's the only thing I'm familiar with the comic run. I don't know who has what power or what, but that's all I know about the comic. It didn't really interest me when it first came out.
Yeah, that's what, like, when they first announced this show, my co-host Sean was, like, losing it and was just kind of talking about how he, like, this series, like, it needs to come out, like, but I think the biggest thing about this whole Runaways television property that I think is really unique is that it's not on Netflix. Marvel and Netflix made this, like, big, costly deal to produce television shows. And originally the deal was a season of Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, and the Defenders. When they started, obviously we know that Daredevil hit a second season, we have a third season, we have a Punisher spinoff coming, and I think it's weird that it's gonna be on Hulu. I'm kind of curious if the tone's gonna be lighter and closer to the movies and maybe closer to the Cloak and Dagger television show that they're talking about, but the idea of having kind of sons and daughters of heroes and villains, like, that interests me.
Yeah, my thought runs similar to you, that where the whole Netflix is dark as heck, and just over, I won't say over violent, but just very mature and adult oriented, that Hulu might take the whole other spin with it in regards to that here is something that is not necessarily lighthearted, but more or less like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is, in a way, mixed in with a little bit of teen angst. That way it captures a little bit of the younger viewers instead of the older viewers. That way, those who, like myself, have cut the cord, kind of have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and I'm a cord cutter too, so, like, I always grew up kind of thinking, like, what would happen? Why do I have to pay for all these television shows that I don't ever watch? Like, why can't there just be a reduced price? And I love the fact that there's now a reduced price with exclusive content. So, this is a whole nother side story for a whole nother episode. But I don't know any of these people. And, like, the only name I feel like on here that I would actually know would be the Ariella Bear, who was from New Girl. And I can't even remember who she played in New Girl, but I'm a New Girl fan, so, like, this kind of gets me, and it sounds like that these, it really sounds like the cast that they have is very diverse in the materials that they either come from or that they're currently famous for, because Teen Wolf obviously is an MTV remake of the 1980 movie that has been kind of modernized for our culture nowadays. A little bit more serious, a little bit of a darker take. So you have that going for it. You have Goat, which is also a darker film that looks at the realistic frat boy life. And you have New Girl, again, lighter comedy kind of side. So you have all of these kind of different takes in the role. So I'm curious to see what's going to come out of this. I'm curious to see what kind of tone they will, because, like I said, I don't know too much about the comics, but from what I've heard about the comics, they're a little bit lighter toned. It's a little bit more fun. It's a little bit more kind of, again, kind of comparing it to the movies, I think is what it would best be compared to.
I'm willing to give at least an episode or two, see how it turns out.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel. And it's not something that's, like, immediately on my radar, but it's something that, like you said, like, I'll give it a shot. I gave Luke Cage a shot, and everyone's like, it was so good. I couldn't get into it.
I enjoyed Luke Cage. I found it very interesting and very appealing, and this is a great way to be introduced to a whole new character that I don't think a lot of people knew about, or if they did know about, were not really that familiar with.
I mean, I've heard a lot of great things about it, and again, whole other story, whole other day. But
yeah,
we are recording the day after the Super Bowl, so of course, for us geeks, I know I can't speak for Chris, but I know for us here at Victims and Villains, we're not really football guys, but one thing we do look forward to every year is the Super Bowl has been kind of like a condensed version of Comic-Con, or when it comes to geeks and film buffs. So every year they do these great trailers that will show off exclusive content. We're here to talk tonight about two of them, of all the ones that got released. And we're talking specifically about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and Logan. So, Chris, which trailer do you want to start with, man?
Let's go with Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Volume 2.
All right, man. What were your initial thoughts on seeing this trailer?
I saw bits and pieces of it, but oh my god, I'm still high. I don't care. I tend to stay away from a lot of, even though I do podcasting as a hobby, like most, I tend to stay away from trailers a lot. Even though I am very stoked for Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and I do want to watch it, from what I've seen of the trailer, the new trailer, it was hysterical. But the reason why I stay away from trailers is because trailers nowadays tend to give away a whole mess of the movie, and it leaves nothing for the enjoyment of the film itself.
Yeah, I can understand that, and we always kind of go back to Power Rangers. I think was a great example of that recently when they released the second trailer for it a couple weeks ago. It revealed so much, and like, of course, as fans, like, we're over here being like, that was awesome, that's great, like, everything we wanted, but it kind of ruins your, I love it, like, I loved it, and I hated it at the same time. I think the second trailer with Doomsday from BVS is another great example. Like, I would have loved to see that kind of go in the theaters, and just not knowing Doomsday was one of the antagonists, but, I loved the way that this trailer started out. I thought that when it started out with them kind of going into that Golden Palace, who, I don't know who they are in the Marvel Universe, but I genuinely loved that scene where she's just like, who the hell do you think you are? And you just kind of see Star-Lord kind of laugh, and he goes like, well? And then it kind of goes into the trailer of, you know, footage we've already seen, and I love the ending with Rocket, Groot, and Yondu. Welcome to the freaking Guardians of the Galaxy. Only he didn't say freaking.
Yeah, I saw that, and that was the whole funny bit for me. So, to go back a little bit, my case in point for the whole trailers ruining the movie, just look at, you could probably find the trailer online, look at, the current Terminator movie with Arnold in it, which was Terminator Genesis, how they just spoiled the whole movie for, in reference to, oh, here's the twist right in the middle of the trailer for it, and you couldn't wait for that. You could have left that whole thing out, and it would have been a great movie, and people would have left the theater going, oh my god. Oh my god, you gotta go see this film. And, you know, you gotta have that suspense in reference to whatever it is, Power Rangers, Guardians of the Galaxy, and we'll be getting into, what's the other trailer we'll be getting into? Logan. You want fans to come out going, oh my god, oh my god. You want fans and people who have seen this calling up their friends saying, oh my god, you gotta see this. You're not gonna believe this whole thing coming up, you know, that happened. I'm not gonna tell you, you just gotta go see it. And that's what brings people to the theater. As my other co-host has said, we are a 24/7 nation right now. We're a 24/7 world, period, with the internet, with Facebook and Twitter and so forth and so on. The more people you can get going, oh my god, you gotta see this, that's what you want. And when you have a trailer that just spoils the twist, or spoils 95% of the movie, You can't have that. You know, you're not going to have the numbers that you were expecting.
I think, too, that they're being very patient with this. They're being very smart with this marketing because they're not really giving too much of the plot. Like, there was an article that I was reading today that up until now we've all thought that Kurt Russell's ego, which has been a lot of talking points that people want to see how Ego actually looks, because in the Marvel comical universe, he's just a planet and a villain. And so everyone thought that it was he was going to be the main villain. Well, I don't remember who reported it, but they had initially said that that's not the case, that there's two other villains that are in the film, but you're not seeing that. So whether or not that report's true or not, you're not seeing it. And I think that Guardians, up until this point, has done a superb marketing job, kind of not giving you too much, but giving you just enough to, like, wet your whistle. Like, I thought the last trailer was a great example of that, where it's just a scene between Rocket and Baby Groot about the death button. Like, it was hilarious. And the introduction of Mantis, like, they're being very patient with it. And I think that I don't think that they're going to spoil it. I don't hope that they're going to spoil it. Like, don't give us any more trailers for this, because right now we have enough to whet our appetite.
Right, right. That's a good thing. It is what you want is to kind of promote it. A lot of people who are fans of the first one want to know, is Baby Groot going to be in it? Yes. That we see that. Is he going to be as cute as possible? Yes. Is it going to be the same humor level as the first one? Yes. So, as long as they keep that aspect and just kind of pushing that and kind of do the whole look over here, look over here, look over here, and kind of keep the awesome away, then the fans will go in, oh my god, it's not only as funny as the first one, it's just as amazing. You got to go see it. And that's what is going to probably drive people to Guardians. And I am going to probably be one of the people to see it in the $5 theater instead of the $10 theater, which will make it even more awesome. But that's just me.
Well, let's move on to something that was a little bit more somber in tone. We got this 30-second Logan trailer. What are your thoughts on hearing a great hymn like Amazing Grace with Logan sharpening his blades?
Oh, it's just, like you said, somber. It's just heartfelt. Again, it's one of those trailers I have to get into again. I am so far behind with my stuff and my research. As you know, being a podcaster, you tend to try to be on forefront of everything. Yet you tend to be so far behind as well. But a lot of it from what I've seen, it's just him. I didn't see the whole or hear the Amazing Grace, but for me, just visually him sharpening his claws and hearing that music makes me want to see the movie and see if that the whole aspect of while that scene's going on, is it just for the trailer or is it part of the movie? So it's going to be there. My only gripes in reference to the trailers I've seen so far of Logan is that where in the comics X-23 is more of a older teen. X-23 in this is a more of a, I won't say a younger teen, but more of a girl.
Probably anywhere between 9 and 12 is my guess.
Right. So I want to see how they work it. It could be pretty decent. They've been handling since the first Wolverine movie, which is Wolverine Origins, they have gotten drastically better with the Wolverine series. So I think this one is going to be rated R as well, so it could be pretty dang good. I'm hoping for the best for it.
Well, this one is rated R, just so you know. And I'm excited about this. This trailer has just the tone of it was really great. I really, really enjoyed the imagery that this trailer brought. It was 30 seconds. It was short, sweet. It was violent. It was everything that you wanted in a Wolverine movie. And, I mean, there's not really, like I said, there's not really too much that you can really say about this, because all the 90% of the imagery that you see in this movie, in this trailer, you've seen in the first two. So there's nothing that's really new. The only real thing that's kind of new that you see in this is kind of a struggling... struggling is probably the best word I can use. Struggling Professor X. But other than that, this trailer looks great, feels great, sounds great. It's visually everything you want from a Wolverine movie.
Well, as long as they're giving a second two of a 3-second conversation that makes you want to hear what second one and second three is going to give, that's always a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's move on from one big bad. I guess I shouldn't say one big bad. One big company to the other. Obviously, we've been talking about Marvel up to this point. Now we're going to switch and go to DC. So last week, we hung out with Delilah Blast, writer and creator Marcel Dupree. And we talked about how Ben Affleck has stepped down as the director of The Batman. And we also talked about who we'd like to see direct The Dark Knight and his Gotham adventures. Now some rumored names have surfaced in Matt Reeves, Gavin O'Connor, Dennis, whose last name I'm not going to try and pronounce, Matt Ross, and George Miller. So just like our Green Lantern discussion a couple weeks ago, who would you like to see direct the billionaire vigilante hybrid from this list?
I'll be jumping ahead of myself in regards to this, but hopefully Zack Snyder. You know, he's part of the industry. I don't know if he's a good directorial fit, but what we need is somebody that kind of knows the background. And as you know, I'm sure you covered it on your show last week or when it broke, that the reason why, or at least the rumored reason why Affleck stepped down as director is because the script apparently wasn't good enough, because that's why he said he'd step down. But what we need is somebody who won't treat it dark. Batman has, even though he's a dark goth type character as it is, what we need is something that would bring a little bit of light to it. That, whereas, like, one of my faults for Batman vs. Superman is that the movie was way too dark, story-wise. It seemed just way too dark. It needed a little bit more light, with a little bit more visual and storyline light to it. I don't know if it's easier to put that into a Batman movie, but we need a director who's able to do that a little bit while still keeping the dark there. I'm not sure who. I don't want to say the Supernatural frontman, because he's doing a good job with Supernatural, but we need somebody who's going to do a decent job with that.
See, I go back to what I said last week in saying Matt Reeves, and Matt Reeves isn't really a name that you look at and say, I know exactly who that is. And again, I will tell you exactly who he is. He is the gentleman directing who took over for Rupert Grant, directing Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, came back for War for the Planet of the Apes, and he took what the director in Rise of the Planet of the Apes did, and, like, that's such a great film already, and he made it better. And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, like, the story, the narrative, the emotion, Just the camera angles, the cinematography was just, it was visually beautiful, it was great, it was gripping, it was emotional when it needed to be, and that is the sign that you have a great director there. And I think that when you look at the complexity that he brought to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I think it's, again, I said this all last week with Marcel, it is such a great thing that he was such a great director with that, and just took this complex storyline and evolution that, you know, was set 10 years after the first one and just improved upon it so greatly. And it looks like he's going to do that again for War for the Planet of the Apes with, you know, Andy Serkis coming back and Woody Harrelson coming to play the villain. It looks like he's bringing so much great, even the trailer that they had for it, just, there was so much great complexity going on with the Caesar character, and he delivered that in such a great way. And I think that when you have a character like Batman and a seasoned actor like Affleck, he would be a perfect choice for that, because Batman is always been such a complex character and such a psychologically gripping character, and I think that you need to have a director that can be able to handle that. While I think that Snyder would be a good fit for him, at the same time, I wouldn't want to see him, because we've already seen his version of the Batman. Like, I wouldn't want to see him direct any more movies in the DCEU that is not Justice League. That's just my, like, I think visually he's a great storyteller, he's perfect, but I don't want to kind of see any more of Zack Snyder. Like, I want to get new feelers in there.
True, I looked at his, the person you mentioned, Matt Reeves' biography, and yes, I'll have to agree with you, he does tend to know how to balance his story just the right way, so that it's not too dark. So if he does step in and step up, I'm willing to see what he has to do and what he takes with it.
Yeah, so, I mean, Warner Bros., you heard it here, right here, right now, Victims and Villains, episode 41. Go get Matt Reeves. Alright, well, it seems that lightning is striking over at CW. All the way back in episode 16 in September, the Pamela Purge with My Ransom Soul. By the way, if you guys have not checked those guys out, go check them out, facebook.com/MyRansomSoul. Just a little shameless plug for some friends. We talked about how Fox was ordering a Black Lightning pilot. Now it seems like the seasoned warrior has been passed from Fox to CW, and the pilot is currently scheduled for a March shoot date, which means we might see this character and father of two suit up for the fall. But the bigger question that you need to ask yourself is, will he be a part of Earth 1, aka the Arrowverse, or Earth 38, who would be in the same one as Supergirl, or would he have his own standalone universe? So, Chris, what are your thoughts on the shuffling from Fox to DC, or from Fox to CW for the Black Lightning show?
CW over the past, I want to say 17 years, has come a long way with their comic book or DC library and how to handle their DC characters, especially over the past several years with Arrow and Flash. And now with Supergirl, the sad thing is with Black Lightning, even I had to look up who this character is, because again, it's one of those instances where when you say the Green Arrow, people tend to know who you mean. When people say the Flash, people know who you mean, especially with Supergirl or Superman or Batman. At least in the DC universe. And if not, it's an easy, if they give an article a glance over, they go, oh yeah, that superhero. But with Black Lightning, it's a little bit harder to figure out who this character is. Looking up this character and this superhero, I've seen the character before, but again, I'm not familiar with this character. He's a more of a side. I don't want to say a C-lister, but he seems like that. He seems like a C-list character. But I don't know how they're going to handle this or how they're going to work this type of character into their universe. Granted, we've seen Killer Frost and Reverb in the Arrow, but with Arrow and the Flash, but I'm not sure how they're going to work a character like this into that universe.
Well, it's really tricky too, because if you had seen the crossover event Invasion that they did this year, they had mentioned how there's a great moment where Oliver and Kara are talking, and they're talking about how on Earth 38, which is her universe, how the only superheroes that have ever existed have been Superman and Supergirl. And this universe, you have, obviously you have Arrow, you have Flash, you have White Canary, you have the Black Canary, you just have so much, and the list goes on and on and on, of just these, you know, this universe that has been created with this single television show. And but I agree that people don't really know him, but I think that something like this is needed. And it's needed for this reason, is that when you look at what we have on the CW right now, it is outside of the Flash, it's predominantly all white superheroes. And this is a seasoned warrior who's been doing this for 20 years. He's hung up his bolts to be a father and has to re-pick up the whole superhero business when his daughters are kidnapped and he goes back into being a superhero. And he's predominantly a African superhero who we, to this point, aside from Mr. Terrific, haven't really seen. So I think that, and that's one thing that the Arrowverse has really done that is really superb and really great, is that they've diversified over the years. You know, it started with this rich, single, white, playboy billionaire, and it's kind of grown from there. Obviously, you know, we've gotten, mind is just not working tonight. We've gotten so many different kind of characterizations. You look at even the crew that they have on Arrow now is a great example of that. You have Wild Dog, who's a Latino character. You have Mr. Terrific, an African character. And then you had Ragman, you know, is just, again, you know, someone, a Jewish character. And then you've introduced, you know, gays and lesbians over the years. So I think that what they're doing is really interesting, but I would like to see kind of what their plans are as far as introducing this character, because to introduce a character that's a quote-unquote seasoned veteran that's been doing it for 20 years, it's a little harder to introduce him in an already established universe.
I'm going to have to agree with you there, but to me, my problem with what the CW tends to do is they tend to overhype the Batman angle, meaning they tend to treat Batman as a four-letter curse word, meaning you'll have all the hints of Batman throughout the all four shows, because I'm including the League of Legends in this, in regards to when Spartan was in Blackgate, you heard it was definitely Harley Quinn. In Supergirl, when they were sitting in that alien-esque bar and they're talking about Kara's cousin's friend who has a billionaire with lots of toys and issues. But what they tend to do is they hint Batman, they promise Batman, or they'll promise another high-level character, whether it be Wonder Woman or this character or that character, and all of a sudden it's going to cheapen Black Lightning. Meaning they're going to hype it. It's like, oh, we're going to have this major superhero come in. It's going to be great. He's been doing this for years. He's very powerful. He's going to be well-liked and this, that, and other thing. And here's Black Lightning. And the fans are going to go, oh, really? This? That's who you're going to give us? We were expecting Batman. Or we were expecting Wonder Woman. But you're giving us Black Lightning. And you're going to have the other fans that are going to go, really, CW, are you really trying to imitate Marvel and the whole aspect of Luke Cage by bringing in this character? And you're bringing it, this character in either in 2018 or 2019. Really? You're kind of coming in on the coattails of Marvel. And some fans might see it that way.
I think it's really important, too. I don't know. I definitely agree, because we've talked about it a lot on this show, is that the one character that they've really hyped up to no end is Green Lantern. And obviously you're not going to see him anytime soon. And I agree. Like, it's still... I just went back a couple months ago and binged the first season of Arrow. And there's so many Dark Knight references in it. Like, it's just not even... It's unreal. And I agree with that, but... I think that television's a great example of taking all of these B and C list characters that you wouldn't normally get their own movie and give them something, give them a launching pad for this. And, you know, I think that, you know, like you said, like, there's not a lot of people that are going to know him. So with that, they're probably, maybe they'll shoot this and they'll order 13 episodes and just kind of test the waters with, you know, where it's going to be. And that's something that I really admire about CW and about the television network that they've done since Smallville, because they've kind of taken these characters that have been taboo or that, you know, normally you wouldn't see, and kind of given them their own show, their own property. But I think it would be smart for them to not do, not necessarily do kind of a pilot episode where you're kind of like bringing these characters right in from the get-go, but introduce them in someone that, you know, like kind of take what the Flash was and kind of repeat that formula.
That's called in the industry, what you're talking about is called a backdoor pilot. Meaning for the fans who are listening to your show, with that, if you're not familiar with that term, shows like Green Arrow and NCIS, what they try to do if they want to test the waters for a new series without building up a brand new production of a show, they'll bring in a character like in Flash, because they're doing this whole Earth 32 or 33 type of ordeal. They'll bring in they could bring in the Black Lantern and test the waters to see what the fans think of it and how that episode ranks in ratings. If they see a high number in ratings, then, okay, let's actually do a pilot for this and see if that solidifies into something. And if that season works, it might be a 13-episode run. And if that run is successful, they'll order a season 2. But who knows?
Well, let's kind of jump into another property that's kind of taking these famous names of the DC universe and kind of trying to build off of them. So this past week, on February 2nd, following Superstore, NBC released a brand new pilot that's set a brand new series that's set in the DC universe that's kind of told from the vantage point of normal people and who are living in these cities. And we're talking about the show Powerless, which stars Vanessa Hudgens and Alan Tudyk. So what were your thoughts on this pilot?
To me, Powerless is the show for, even though it's geared a little bit towards the geek culture, it's geared more so the non-geeks. The issue that I see with this, it's going to be the invention of the week. And at the end of, again, I have to see more episodes to see if I'm right or not. Whereas, like, at the end of the pilot, spoilers if you haven't seen it already, but they take an item that's been kind of the running gag in the show, they turn it into an invention, into a smaller, useful invention, and at the end of the episode, Batman uses it for to stop a crime in Gotham. And that's my fear, that they're going to take this running gag of, oh, we're going to close down the department this week unless we come up with something that we need to use. Then it's going to cycle through, oh, we got a new light, we're back in business. And it just, I'll give it another episode or two, but if it might not congeal with me.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like the jokes in this kind of really felt short. Or I think the best way to kind of all the promotional stuff that they did, it was kind of almost like they took the best jokes that played really well with people and put those in the promotional material. I thought as a DC fan, kind of getting to see kind of villains like Jack-O-Lantern or Crimson Fox and, well, Hero Crimson Fox, and also kind of seeing a villain like Starro, I thought that that kind of made my fanboy kind of go, ooh, I feel all warm and tingly inside. But I agree. Like, it just, the jokes really didn't hit with me. And it's like, I really wanted to like it. And I remember last week, like, I was counting down the days till it premiered. And it just totally did not click with me. And I wanted to like it so bad. I don't see this show lasting really long. I read an article on Comic Book Resources where they debuted actually with really, really bad numbers, which is kind of disappointing because you're following Superstore, which is a great comedy. If you've never checked out Superstore before, go watch it. It is awesome.
And that's the thing a lot of networks tend to look at, is that if you have a show like Superstore that has a decent to high ratings on a per weekly basis, what they tend to look at is how many people are those from that show moving over to this new show. And if they're not getting that, that show is not going to really last that long in that slot. They might move it to a different slot to see where it works. If it doesn't work there, it's going to go.
Yeah, and I don't know. I really wanted to like it. I thought that the Alan or Van Wayne, I thought that his character was just so over-the-top ridiculous. Like, it was, I don't know if it was written that way or if Alan Tudyk acted it that way, but it felt like it was just overacted to me, and it really just took me out of it. So it's kind of a disappointment as a DC fan, because it's such a great concept, because even the theme song of it, like, they're kind of going throughout the, if you guys didn't get a chance to watch it, essentially the theme song takes these classic covers of DC lore and kind of focuses in on the background characters, and that's how the names appear. I think most notably they had shown Action Comics number 1, which is the first appearance of Superman, and then they had shown Sensation Comics number 40, which was the first appearance of Wonder Woman, and there was two other covers that they had. One of them was an old Batman from the 70s or 80s, and then you also had a Green Lantern from the 70s or 80s that I don't think were, like, majorly significant issues, but, like, that part of it was cool. Like I said, again, like, kind of getting to see some of these characters that we won't for a fact see on the big screen or the small screen, like, anytime soon. Getting to see those was cool, but I felt like the jokes in this kind of fell short a lot. And
I'm not saying the show it's not a great concept. It is. But, or it's a great spin for it. Let's see it from the average Joe's point of view. Okay. But here you have, in regards to Alan Tudyk's character, he was probably playing it serious and trying to be this decent role and trying to handle it as a decent actor and a seasoned actor as well. But how much you want to bet that the people behind the scenes were going, Alan, you're not being Alan enough. Play it up some more. Play it up. Play it up. Play it up. And all of a sudden, as you said, he's overplaying the role. So
that's very well possible.
The best part of Alan Tudyk is that when he's not really playing a role, he's adding his little bit of his personality into it, but he's doing it just enough that the character overshines his personality, but not the vice versa. And in this, they're trying to, we really want the goofy Alan in this instead of the Bruce Wayne-y type of, or the cousin or the business sense of who he should be, or putting his take into it. So it could be a mixture. Unless we know more or hear from Alan, we'll never know.
Right. Well, let's so that episode is streaming on NBC.com if you guys want to watch that. It's also Hulu. We weren't too big fans of it, it doesn't sound like, but let's move on to something that has really starting to stir up some oceans. Aquaman is really starting to shake up to be one of the movies to watch out for next year. And you never probably would have said that like 10 years ago when it had a failed concept for a pilot. And not only that, but also was the running joke of the Big Bang Theory in that Aquaman sucks water. Now it truly has, it just has an immense amount of talent, whether you're talking about James Wan behind the camera, the hulking hurricane known as Jason Momoa as the king and hero, not to mention talents like Patrick Wilson and Amber Heard, and now we're getting loaded with even more talent in this. Reports are coming out that Tamara Morrison is gonna, who was in Star Wars, to play, they're courting him to play Arthur Curry's father, Oscar winner, and Nicole Kidman to play his mother, and villain in up-and-coming Netflix star Yahan Abdul-Mahdi II, as Black Manta. So all this news is around the same production. What do you think about adding all of this talent into this big movie?
Well, they do have a fine list for the exception. I won't say for the exception. It's just that I've never really seen the character, the actor who's playing Black Manta in anything on Netflix. That I'm not saying he's not on Netflix, but the things that he's done. So I wouldn't mind seeing how this movie finally turns out. Even though a lot of this, as you, even you stated, it was the big joke. It, next to Wonder Woman, Aquaman couldn't get traction anywhere. TV, movies. But now we're seeing an Aquaman movie. We're seeing a Wonder Woman movie. But I want to see more more of what's going to happen. They have a decent lineup, other than the Nicole Kidman and Morrison. A lot of people, I won't say I'm worried, but how many people have said that when, like, The Dark Knight Returns came out, they were worried. When the first Batman movie came out back in the early to mid-90s, or whenever it was, with Michael Keaton, they were worried. When you know, you name it, when Iron Man came out, we're worried. But we'll see. This could be one of those things that everybody's going to be going in saying, we're worried. We don't think that this is going to work. This is not going to work. What's his name? Jason Momoa. Yeah. Is not going to work for Aquaman. He might look the part. It's not going to work. And all of a sudden, once the movie comes out, everybody's going to be going, oh my god, that was amazing. You got to go see it. But I'm going to me personally, I'm going to hold a wait and see on this because a lot of things with DC has been iffy for me, for the exception of Suicide Squad, which I liked way better than Batman versus Superman. But that's just me. I'll give it a onesie, but who knows?
So I don't know anything about the, like, I'm a Star Wars guy, but I don't know, like, in depth, like, characters and names and all that other good stuff. But so as for that, like, that bit of casting news, like, I have faith, like we were talking about earlier, that you wouldn't necessarily see people like that in those roles, and then they cast them and they do awesome. And so my hope is that bringing in a talent like Nicole Kidman is the thing about Aquaman's mom, is that recently they've actually, and I don't know too much about the mythology, but they've actually made her into a super awesome villain, actually. And so my hope is that we will eventually, somewhere down the line, if they sign Nicole Kidman to this role, is that we will eventually get to see that complexity brought out on the big screen. Because I would love to see Jason Momoa and Nicole Kidman go up. I feel like Nicole Kidman is a terrific actress. I haven't really seen her in too much over the past couple years. She's been kind of taking that Pierce Brosnan route and kind of doing like smaller budget movies. But I've loved her in everything that I've ever seen her in. I don't think there's ever been a Nicole Kidman performance that I haven't seen or liked. And so I think that bringing her in, it never hurts to add talent to your movie. And but I've never seen the man's name, who I'm not going to try and pronounce again, playing Aquaman, or playing Black Manta in Aquaman, but they did a side-by-side picture of the two of them, and they look almost exactly the same. Like, they just look visually so close to the comic panel, and he's in the Netflix series The Get Down. It's kind of about the 70s disco era, so to say, I guess. I don't know too much about the show. I just know a little bit more about what I've seen kind of as suggestions on Netflix. But I think it'll be good. I think that, like we were talking about earlier, like, DC's been very, very picky. I don't want to say picky, but they've been very smart about who they're picking, and they're kind of picking these unconventional choices and really running with them, because I never would have in a million years said Jason Momoa should be the one for Aquaman. Like, I would have said something lame like Ryan Gosling or, you know, Bradley Cooper, or someone like just has that built, that not really rugged, I'm going to tear your kingdom down kind of look that Momoa possesses. But I'm excited, so this is definitely one of my most anticipated movies of next year.
The only thing that really scares me about Aquaman is that a lot of the people that are cast for this are not really big box office draws. Nicole Kidman hasn't been, what's she been in recently? Pulling it up. Oop, that's soundtrack. Last thing she's been in recently is How to Talk to Girls at Parties. But it's kind of hard to say when someone hasn't been in a major box office draw for a while. Everything that, I'm not knocking any of these actors and actresses, but the person who's playing Black Manta in this is the one that might be getting the most exposure out of this. Even if it is if it's a flop, he might not see too many roles in the future because he was part of a flop and he's only done one or two other things. But if this movie's a success, he's going to be launched. This might be considered by some for Jason to be a comeback because being in Conan and a lot of other films that kind of tanked in recent years or wasn't really that big of a success, this could be his comeback. But then again, if it's not, he's not going to see too much in the future. That could be worrisome for some.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm looking. I have her IMDb page pulled up now, and like just some of the roles that she has taken on in the last couple of years have been smaller budget independent films. And it's one of the podcasts that I listen to analyzes movies, and they're kind of for movie buffs, but they're talking about, like, in the 90s, like, it was, and even in the early 2000s, you would have these big box office names that would draw people out to come to your movie. Nowadays, you don't really have that. Like, you just have movies that look good and talent that backs it up. So I don't think it necessarily matters that she hasn't been in anything in a while, because she has. A couple years ago, she did Before I Go to Sleep. She did Paddington, got really Secret in Their Eyes, Lion. She's everything that she's turned in the last couple years. It's really been a critical hit for her.
To me, that's always been the downside. From what I've seen, still kind of here, even though a lot of the Hollywood market has changed, especially with the big success with a lot of these superhero franchises, Hollywood is still very much old school. You might not hear it too much, but Hollywood still kind of blacklists a lot of people, meaning that if they are really good in cop roles, they're going to keep that person in cop and action roles, and even though that person might want to branch out into drama or comedy, they just pigeonhole these people, these actors or actresses, in these roles. And it's been a very few special cases where they've branched out into other parts, either some for the better, some for the worse.
Yeah, that's true, and we've definitely seen stuff that's like that, and you really want to make sure that you're seeing diversity. And I think that she's really a someone that can show diversity, and this entire cast that they've done so far has really done diverse stuff. And you look at James Wan, even, you know, he got his start doing Saw franchise, and he went on, and he's probably most famously known for doing Saw and The Conjuring and Insidious, but he's done great other projects. Like, he did one of the Fast and Furious movies that was probably the best in the series. He's done Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon and Garrett Hollin, and so he's a talent. And then you look at Patrick Wilson, who has done a whole plethora of different things, whether you're talking Watchmen, or you're talking The Conjuring, or, you know, just Insidious. Like, he's done so many different things, and it's really what it comes down to is this film isn't about, I don't think DC's really kind of going after names anymore. Aside from Ben Affleck, I think that they're kind of going more for talent. Because we had Captain Kyle in here last week, and we were talking about the DC universe, and, you know, he didn't know who Ezra Miller was. And Ezra Miller is a talented dude who's an up-and-coming actor who's going to make a name for himself. Same with Ray Fisher, who hasn't really done anything too big or too major. So I think that they're going more after talent than they are big names.
Sure, I'm going to have to agree with you there, but the only downside is how the final product is going to look. You had a lot of big names with I think with Batman versus Superman, but when you have a lot of, even though it was a good movie, to me it seemed very murky, meaning that you had too many storylines going on at once. If they try to do that, something similar with Aquaman or Wonder Woman, it's going to put off fans for one, and those who are not fans are going to get confused. So that's where I think DC's losing the battle overall, aside from making their movies a little bit too dark. We'll see how it turns out. They learned their lesson a little bit with Suicide Squad, and we'll see how these other movies come out and deal.
Agreed. It goes back to, again, what we were saying at the beginning of the show, that you know, we might not see a certain actor in a certain role, or like we might not see really what they're thinking as far as like they're shaping up their movie, but it all comes down to that final product. So, speaking of final product, that's going to do it for us. This is the part one of the Long Coat Mafia podcast crossover, and we will be on their show on Monday, this upcoming February the 13th. But before we kind of tell you about our great weekend coming up, Chris, where can people find the Long Coat Mafia on social media?
Well, they could find us on Facebook by searching for the Long Coat Mafia podcast. We are on Twitter and Instagram by the same handle. It's Long Coat Mafia. And if they need more information, they could always email us at longcoatmafia@gmail.com.
All right. Well, you guys can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Podomatic, iTunes, and our network, along with all the other amazing shows on Nerd Herder. It's facebook.com/nerdherdernews. And come out to, if you live in Virginia and you're hearing this right now, or you're just discovering us, welcome. We are going to be in Haven House and Norfolk, Virginia, February 11th, this Saturday. And we'll be at Identity House February 12th in Ashland, Virginia, right outside of Richmond, this weekend, speaking. And I will be preaching. We're Victims and Villains is presenting An Evening in the Desperate Universe, which is my other podcast. So go check that out. And also, too, we are just saying that if you guys wish to donate to our show, we have links on our website, victimsandvillains.net/donate. And what the funds go to, we have either PayPal or Patreon. And what all the funds that we get through those online giving or church events or just anything that we get at conventions or shows or just anything, really all our funds go back into future travels for us to speak out on suicide awareness. And I know you're listening to this right now and saying, well, this is the show that talks nerd and we talk hope. We've talked a whole heck of a lot of nerd tonight. Well, do not fear, because we are going to be talking hope here in just a little bit. And we're actually going to be closing on hope, so that way you guys can be hopeful for the Long Coat Mafia part of our crossover. But you guys can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, /Captain Nostalgia. And check out my other podcast, Desperate Universe. Chris, thank you for hanging out with us this week, man. And we look forward to being on your show.
Hey, no problem. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Lumser. I am the main host and frontman for the Long Coat Mafia podcast. For many years, I have suffered from depression and anxiety. It's not an easy battle. Back in high school, I have attempted suicide twice. The reason why I say that is that it was involved a revolver and bullets, loaded gun. I made the attempt to see if I could do it. I adjusted the chambers to an empty chamber to make sure I could do it. And both times I pretty much surprised myself that I was able to do it. It was all stemmed from what I believed, being in a controlled family setting. This is not known. new for a lot of people out there. And me coming out of this, it's a struggle day to day, week to week, especially having over the past several years, parents dying, good friends leaving me, exes leaving me. It's not easy. It's a struggle. The best thing I could tell all of you out there is to find a good friend that's able to talk to you, if not get at least a lot of good help out there. Because for me, I went with the angry route, and I still do. It's what drives me forward on a day-to-day basis. But there are a lot of days that it hits me hard. It hits me that I don't want to go outside. I don't want to do what I need to do. Don't want to go to work. But do it. It's almost like an addiction. You want to go back down that dark path, to go over that edge, to find something to go back to that spot. That darkness is not what you want to do. Stay away from it. Find some place, find something that would bring you back to be light in your life. Whether it be a positive person in your life, an activity, listening to a podcast, doing art, volunteering, something to keep you out of there. Please stay away. I struggle with it. It's very hard. And going down that dark path is not something. It's not a pretty sight. It hurts. It does. You might think at times that your soul is gone. Because there are a lot of things out there that will eat away at that. Stay positive. There's a lot of hope out there. Listen to this podcast, Victims and Villains. Listen to these guys. Follow their advice. Take their help. No matter even if you know somebody that needs it, help them out. Even if you're not suffering from anxiety, depression, or suicidal thoughts, please get help.
This week we are reviewing Delilah Blast, and if that name sounds familiar, you guys go back to the Lord Lost episode 39, because this is written by Mr. Marcel Dupree, our guest from last week. And so this week we are reviewing the first issue, which goes into a Kickstarter next week, February 16th, 2017. So let's get started. All right, so Delilah Blast is written by Marcel Dupree. You have art by Joel Cotillard, who we talked so heavily about last week. You have colors from Ramin Birch, and then you have lettering from Marcelo Della Verte. So a lot of talent in this book. All right, so the series circles around a 16-year-old Delilah Blast, whose father has recently died, and her desire to join the ESA and get answers to awaken answers to her nightmare, which opens the book. So let's start with the art in this book. Like we were talking so heavily about last week, Joel's art in this book is simply breathtaking. It is one of the main reasons that this book is great. And it feels modern, but it also has a throwback to Todd Kleene, who did the art with Mark Waid, writing the Wally West Flash run in the mid-90s. So that's kind of what I went to. It's sleek, yet it's colorful, innovative at the same time. And which, when you actually balance two different styles of art, it really shows that the artist has the depth, he has a vision, that his talent complements so nicely, and his vision and his depth, they shake hands in this the entire book. The one issue that I had with this art was diversity, or lack thereof, and when it comes to the races of this planet. So I don't know if that's how it was envisioned when they sat down, because last week Marcel and Joel, Marcel talked about how they'd been working on this book for 7 years. So they mention at one point in this book the setting that we are seeing on Earth is in fact Earth. The setting looks almost like Mad Max inspired, and that's awesome because I'm a huge Mad Max fan. But you kind of know that this is Earth between a conversation of Delilah and Colonel Blast, who is explaining this kind of like lack of snow. She's talking about this nightmare. But it's weird because this is set in the future. It has a future, very future-esque vibe to it, and you see races like Caucasian, African, and Latino, and then there's just this random blue girl who is our main character. It just feels a little odd to me that you have all of these races, and then you just have this one alien race. And I don't know, I feel like if there would have been a little bit more color diverse, like I said, it has a sci-fi feel to it. It's a sci-fi space adventure, so it wouldn't be unheard of to have aliens come and stay on this Earth, or that they would have settled here. You know, the universe is so vast, it's not uncommon to think that, you know, it would have. But maybe that's how this book is trying to set itself apart, is it's trying to set itself apart by throwing one random race in here, one family that just happens to live on Earth. I don't know, maybe I feel like that's the biggest part it was lacking here. It was definitely that diversity. I felt like the majority of the characters that I was seeing were traditional white man kind of thing. The art was solid, so I can't complain. It definitely fits the tone that the team behind this book was establishing without, you know, being too subtle or too over the top. The writing on this book by Mr. Marcel Dupree is something else. Like I'd mentioned last week with Demons, I felt like there were, again, pacing problems in this book. I loved how it opened on this nightmare and how they kind of explored this. They kind of explored it briefly between a conversation between Delilah and Colonel Wilson, as I had kind of talked about later, and you kind of think that it's setting up to go more in depth with this snow machine that they've invented, because in this history and in this mythology, snow has not existed for 200 years, the book says. But I would have liked to see kind of a little bit more, you know, what this book does. Because this book shows you them turning on this machine and then Delilah's heading into space. Like, I don't know, it just kind of felt a little bit rushed to me that way. But again, I don't know if this nightmare, the snow machine, and kind of the space adventure that they are introducing, as well as the death of her father and how the ESA plays into that, I don't know how that will play in the overarching arc of the story, the characters, and the mythology. That's my hope. This is only the first part. This is only the first issue in this series. The narrative for this issue is big, bold, it's ambitious, and there are times where that kind of got in the way. Like, I did not hate this book. I had fun with it. It feels fun. It's a space opera. It's steampunk. It's two genres that don't really mesh well together, meshing well together. But like I said, at the start of this arc, the start of this series, I hope that all five of these kind of threads that I picked out, whether you're, like, again, talking about Delilah's nightmare, this snow machine, the space adventure, her dad, and the ESA, I hope that they kind of all get tied up by the end of the series. And I've started comic series and television series that have really introduced all of these little, unseemingly ambitious storylines that, like this book, kind of feel muffled at first, and then when you sit back and look at the property as a whole, it flows together, it feels well. But I would have liked to see a little bit more backstory about her dad. I think that is really interesting, because the very brief thing that you kind of hear about him, he seems like a really noble, really good guy, We don't get to see a lot of him in here. We don't actually see any of him in here. He's kind of talked about as a head nod, his character. I would have liked to see that, the transition between the turning on of the space, the snow machine, and the them traveling into space. I would have liked to kind of see a little bit better transition from that. But overall, the art in the story, it's solid, it's great, it mirrors perfectly the tone of the narrative. It's a colorful throwback to the time of grunge and scrunchies, while never really feeling larger than life. The writing leaves me hopeful. It leaves me wanting more. The cliffhanger at the end of the book indeed whet my appetite for the future stories and all of these other narratives that the story set up that Dupree is doing for this. They kind of threw me off at first read, but I did. I read this issue twice, and at first it kind of threw me off, and I had more of an appreciation. The second time I went to go read it, and made me definitely want more. Like I said, the nightmare of the snow machine, the father, the space adventure, all aspects of the story I would like to see come full circle. I hope that they come full circle, but it's a fun adventure to an original world, into a dystopian future. And I would score this book a solid 3 out of 5. So come back next week. We'll have a link on our website to the Kickstarter campaign. But until then, you guys can click the link on our website below and check out the Facebook and all the art that accumulates with it.